Well, if you'll turn back in your Bibles to that passage that we read earlier on, John's Gospel, chapter 4, and the first 26 verses. Where do we begin? We're going to join Jesus sitting next to a well outside a city called Sychar in the region of Samaria. But we might ask, what's Jesus doing here? After all, Jesus was a Jew. The Jews and the Samaritans couldn't stand each other. There was an ingrained hatred between them going back centuries. So much so that generally the Jews and the Samaritans avoided each other like the plague. So what's Jesus doing here in Samaria? Well, verse 1, we read that trouble is brewing for Jesus in Judah, in the southern region of Israel. And so what does Jesus do? Well, verse 3, he left Judah and departed again to Galilee. So Jesus is heading from south to north. Now, the direct route would lead straight through Samaria. But as we've already said, the Jews and the Samaritans hated each other. So most Jews, rather than travelling the straightforward route through the region of Samaria, most Jews would take the long way round. But that's not what Jesus does. Jesus chooses to travel through Samaria in order to meet this unnamed Samaritan woman. Jesus could have taken three routes. Two of those would have kept him in Jewish territory. He would have been in familiar surroundings. Surroundings where he'd naturally feel comfortable, with people he had been near or with all of his life. But Jesus chooses the route which will take him out of his comfort zone. Jesus chooses the route which will take him into unfamiliar territory, possibly hostile territory. Why? Because Jesus loves sinners. And here in Samaria, there's a sinner that needs to be saved. So, we come back to Jesus sitting next to a well outside the city of Sychar. His disciples have gone into the city to buy some food. Jesus is tired, and so he's sitting down having a rest. It's midday, the sixth hour. And at this point, verse 7, a woman comes to get some water. So now there are two people at the well, Jesus and this woman. So what we're going to do in our first point is we're simply going to listen to their conversation. We're going to be a fly on the wall, I suppose you could say a fly on the well, of their conversation. And we're going to break that conversation up into five short sections. And so the first section is a simple request. Jesus starts their conversation by doing something shocking. He asks her for a drink. But how does she respond? Well, I'm sure you've been in the situation before. You're in the doctor's surgery or the dentist's. It's late afternoon. And there's a receptionist. She's been sitting there probably for 7 or 8 hours. She looks grumpy. She's not in the mood for small talk. But you need to talk to her. So what do? You go up and you sort of put your politest voice on. And you say, I couldn't trouble you for something, could I? And she barely raises her eyes to you. And the look she does give you is a look full of disdain. And she simply gives you a cold, short answer. You're as sweet as pie. She's as bitter as lemon. Well, that's what's going on here, isn't it? Jesus asks for a simple favour, a drink, at midday, under the midday sun. And what response does he get? He gets a cold, short answer. Verse 9, how is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? This woman's shocked and a bit angry that Jesus has asked such a thing. After all, generally, the Jews look down on the Samaritans. No Jew would ask to use a Samaritan's cup. But not only is Jesus asking a Samaritan for a drink, but Jesus is speaking to a Samaritan woman. Generally in these days, men didn't talk to women in public. In fact, some Jewish rabbis didn't even speak to their wives in public. But here's Jesus asking a Samaritan woman to give him a drink. No Jewish man, let alone a Jewish rabbi, would ever dream of doing such a thing. And so we can see this woman shocked, and we can see this by the rudeness of her answer. She doesn't look at this stranger who's obviously tired, sitting under the full glare of the midday sun, and take pity on him. She just says, "Why are you asking me?" In fact, as far as we can tell, Jesus never gets his drink. So things seem to have got off to a bad start, don't they? What's Jesus going to do to recover this conversation? Well, he's going to stimulate her curiosity. So our second section in this conversation, a gift offered. Verse 10, Jesus says to her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." Jesus wants to stimulate this woman's curiosity, and we can tell that he has. Because verse 11 and 12, now we can see that actually she's asking some questions. Now she wants to know, who is this man? And what is he offering? So verse 11, she asks, "How can you give this living water when you've got nothing to get it out of the well with?" But her curiosity, it goes beyond where Jesus is going to get this water, doesn't it? Because verse 12, already in her mind, are some deep questions about this stranger's identity. Verse 12, she says, "Are you greater than our father Jacob?" It's obvious that this woman is curious. She's curious about what Jesus has said, but it's also obvious that she hasn't got a clue what he's going on about. She thinks he's talking about some kind of magic water. So Jesus makes it even plainer. Verses 13 and 14. Jesus answered and said to her, "Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again," pointing to the water in the well. "But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life." So what's Jesus doing? Jesus is drawing a contrast between the water in the well and the water that he could give. The water in the well could satisfy thirst temporarily, whereas the water that Jesus is offering can quench the inner thirst forever. The water in the well had to be drawn up, and that was hard work. This well, even today, is about 75 feet deep. Back then it was probably deeper. That water had to be drawn up, but the water that Jesus offers will bubble up from within. So what is this living water? What is Jesus going on about? Well, Jesus is speaking about something more than physical water, isn't he? Jesus is talking about something spiritual. A spiritual change within, when God himself comes into a person's life and satisfies that deep inner spiritual thirst. Maybe you yourself, you understand something of that inner thirst. You go out at night and you look at the stars. And you see the vastness of the universe. And the only questions you ask are, who made this? And who's beyond the stars? Who's really out there? Or you look at your life and you search for meaning and purpose in the seemingly random events of daily life. And as you think about life, you want your life to have meaning and purpose. You don't just want to have a meaningless existence. You want something more, something deeper than simply what you can feel and see and touch and experience. And it's this inner thirst, this thirst for something more, which Jesus is claiming he can satisfy. But has this woman understood? Has she got what Jesus is going on about? Well, no. Verse 15. Sir, give me this water that I may not thirst. Seems to be going well up until that point, doesn't it? But then she reveals she still hasn't really understood. Sir, give me this water that I may not thirst, nor come here to draw. This woman has completely missed the point. She still thinks that Jesus is talking about some kind of magic water. It doesn't matter how plain Jesus makes it. Even mentioning everlasting life. She still just doesn't get it. She hasn't connected the dots of what he's saying. So how is Jesus going to make this woman understand? Well, now Jesus is going to apply the need of living water to her life directly. And so we come to the third part of our conversation, lifting the lid. Jesus now makes another request, verse 16. He says, go call your husband. If you want this living water, okay, go and get your husband and you can have some. What does a hedgehog do when it's frightened or angry? It curls up in a little ball and it sticks all its spikes out and it gets prickly, doesn't it? Well, this is what this woman is doing, isn't it? She gets prickly at this. A minute ago, she was talking happily, but now she simply dismisses Jesus' request with a few short, sharp words. She says, I have no husband. Why so short? Why so prickly? Well, it's at this point that Jesus reveals that he's no ordinary stranger. In one short sentence, Jesus lifts the lid on this woman's past life. Verse 17 and 18. You have well said, I have no husband. For you have had five husbands. And the one whom you now have is not your husband. In that you spoke truly. These are uncomfortable words for this woman to hear, isn't it? Aren't they? Jesus is exposing the trail of broken relationships that she's left behind her in her life and highlighting that now she's living with a man who's not her husband. She's living in sin. So what is Jesus doing? Jesus is confronting this woman's sin. But what is her sin? What's she done wrong? And why is Jesus bringing this up now? Doesn't it seem like a strange thing to bring up at this point in the conversation? Well, remember what Jesus has already said to her. He said, I can offer you water, which when you drink it, will mean you never thirst again. I can offer you something which will really and fully satisfy the deepest desires of your soul. So what has Jesus been offering her? Jesus has been offering a relationship with God. A relationship that will last forever. A relationship that will give and keep on giving. A relationship that will offer true satisfaction. But where has this woman, up until this point, been looking for that satisfaction and fulfillment? Not in a relationship with God, but in relationships with men. Her life hasn't revolved around God like it should have. It's revolved around the enjoyment and pleasures of sexual relationships and the pursuit of the perfect man. She's taken the relationship with men and she's made it into an idol. And Jesus now is exposing her idolatry. She's taken the intimate relationship between a man and a woman, which is a gift from God and is a good thing, and she's completely ignored the one who gave it. She's like the little boy who on his birthday gets an Xbox. And he doesn't say thank you to his mum and dad. He simply takes his present, goes upstairs, and spends the rest of the day playing video games and ignoring his parents who were so kind to give him the gift. That's what this woman's done, isn't it? She's taken the good things that God has given, the gift, the intimate relationship between a man and a woman, and she's focused her life on that. She's revolved her life around that. And she's completely ignored the one who gave the gift. But not only has she ignored the one who gave the gift, she's abused the gift itself. Not only is this woman guilty of not living for God and not giving God the proper place in her life, but what she's focused her life on simply hasn't satisfied. In searching for happiness and fulfillment in the wrong things, she's come up empty. Those things she's invested in, they haven't paid the dividends that she hoped they would. And that's why she's hopped from one failed relationship to the next. She's been thirsty for real satisfaction and fulfillment, and she's been trying to quench that thirst herself through relationships with men. But relationship after relationship after relationship has failed. It hasn't worked. And after each relationship has failed, she's found herself feeling thirsty again and longing for true happiness, longing for real satisfaction. So can we see why Jesus brings this up now? He's exposing that in her life, she is thirsty. She does need this living water. She does need that relationship that can really satisfy. Essentially, he's saying to her, you're thirsty. You need this living relationship, this living water. Your life shows how thirsty you really are. But of course, all this is hitting a bit too close to the bone for this woman. It's uncomfortable to hear what Jesus is saying. So what's her response? We come to the fourth section in our conversation, a red herring. Yesterday, a group of us went into Hounslow to share the gospel. And there was a young boy, maybe 14 or 15 years old, called Mohammed. And Mohammed stopped and listened as I was preaching. And then we started getting into a conversation. And before Mohammed was going to go, I said to him, Mohammed, you're a sinner. you're guilty before God. And if you're guilty before God, how can you ever get to heaven when your life comes to an end? Now, it was obvious what I was saying was hitting home. Because in the next breath, he threw up a theological question. He said, you Christians, you say that Jesus is the Son of God, but how can God have a son? Well, that's a good question. It's a good question if he really wanted it to be answered, but he didn't. All he wanted was to try and get off of the subject of his sin and his guilt before God. And that's what this woman does. Verse 19 and 20. The woman said to him, sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship. She throws up a theological red herring about worship in order to get off of the subject of her sin and her spiritual thirst. Maybe that's what you do sometimes. Maybe you come to church very regularly. You listen to the gospel. Christians try to speak to you about your need of Jesus. But in your mind, stored away, you've got a whole bunch of red herrings. You've got a stock of red herrings that you just wheel out any time someone gets that bit too close. Maybe it's the hypocrisy in the church. And you say, well, if Christians are like this, how can you possibly tell me that God is like you say he is? Or maybe it's just the age-old one of, why does God allow suffering? Good questions, if you really want an answer. But for you, they're not questions that need an answer, are they? They're just convenient excuses for you to carry on ignoring God and to live your life the way you want. Well, that's what this woman does. She throws up a theological red herring. Watch Jesus' response. Well, he runs with it, doesn't he? He answers her question. But in doing so, he brings her right back to the subject of her relationship with God. So verses 21 to 24. This woman wants to talk about religion. She wants to talk about where God ought to be worshipped. But Jesus makes it clear that it's not about doing the right things in the right places. It's about having a right relationship with God. He says, verse 21, that neither the temple in Jerusalem, nor for that matter, the mountain that the Samaritans worshipped on, neither one of those were of any value if the one worshipping wasn't right with God. That's why Jesus makes the point in verse 24. He says, God is spirit. He's not restricted to a particular place. Worshipping God isn't about being in the right location. It's about the heart. And therefore, verse 24, those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. To know God and to worship God properly isn't about doing the right things on the outside. It's not about having a bit of religion that makes us feel better. It's about approaching God in the right way, with a heart that truly wants him. So can you see what Jesus is doing? This woman's squirming. She keeps on trying to get away from the subject. She's prickly. Or she throws up red herrings. But Jesus won't let this subject drop. Jesus keeps on coming back to this woman's need of the living water. Jesus keeps on bringing her back to her need of a relationship with God which can offer real and true satisfaction. And so we come to the final part of our conversation. The man she's been waiting for. All these things seem a little bit beyond her. How can she ever understand? Well, it's okay, she says, verse 24. When the Messiah comes, He'll explain everything. Now, the Messiah was the man who had been promised would come and establish the kingdom of God on earth. He was the one that both the Jews and the Samaritans were waiting for and longing for. And it's at this point, as this woman shows a real desire to hear the truth from the lips of the Messiah, it's at this point that Jesus is ready to show his hand. Jesus is now ready to reveal his identity. He says to her, verse 26, "I who speak to you am he." Jesus is saying, "I'm the Messiah. I'm the one you've been waiting for." And we can see what effect this revelation has on this woman. As she realizes who it is she's talking to, suddenly everything starts falling into place. Here's the man, the only man she's ever met, who could satisfy her deep inner thirst. Here's a man who offers a relationship that will really satisfy. And we can see how affected she is because she runs into the city and tells everyone what's happened. And because of her, many of the men and the women probably come out of the city to meet Jesus themselves, and they put their faith in him. So in this conversation, what have we seen? This woman's gone from a distrustful, suspicious of Jesus' motives, to one of Jesus' followers. But so what? What does that mean for us? After all, we've heard what Jesus said to the woman, but what does that mean for you and me? Well, we come to our second point. If we've heard what Jesus said to the woman, now let's hear what Jesus is saying to us. And firstly, we're going to ask a question, or two questions, in fact. Are you making the same mistakes as this woman? Are you committing the same sin as this woman? What does your life revolve around? What's at the center of your life? Or to put it another way, what gets you up in the morning? What drives your life? You know, we can make idols of almost anything, can't we? In fact, there was a great Christian man who lived centuries ago called John Calvin. He said that our hearts are a factory of idols. An idol is something that takes our focus and our worship away from God, isn't it? So the people we love, or the stuff we own, or the ambitions we have, if our lives revolve around these things, if these are the things which drive us, if these are the things which get us up in the morning, if these are the things, rather than God, which we live our life for, then, my friend, they're your idols. And that's what this woman has done, isn't it? The companionship of the opposite sex, sexual pleasure itself, she's put these things at the centre of her life, and she's ignored the God who should have taken first place in her life. And maybe tonight you're doing the same thing. Maybe your children, your career, your husband or your wife, your boyfriend or girlfriend, your partner, whatever it may be, or simply having fun and enjoying life. Maybe these are the things that you're living for. And these are the things that your life revolves around. You devote your life to these things. And you look for happiness and fulfillment and purpose and an identity in these things rather than the God who has made you and the God who has given these things. Of course, these things, they're good in and of themselves, aren't they? They're gifts from God. From a God who gives us all things richly to enjoy, the Bible says. But what have we done? We've taken the gift and we've made it an idol. We've revolved our lives around what God has given and ignored the one who gave it. Just like this woman had. And maybe like this woman, maybe you're starting to realise that these things, actually they don't satisfy. Maybe you're starting to realise that what you've invested your life in just doesn't pay the dividends you had hoped for. Maybe you're realising that like this woman, the idols which you've put so much into just couldn't live up to the billing. This woman looked for happiness in men, didn't she? But she found that they just couldn't offer what she was looking for. And so she went from one failed relationship to the next, relationship after relationship after relationship, looking for happiness, looking for satisfaction, but always feeling thirsty. Never finding the satisfaction, the meaning, the purpose in her life that she so longed for. And maybe that's what you're experiencing yourself. All your life, you've been living simply for the things of this world. Your family, your career, having fun, the stuff you own. And your life has revolved around these things. But now you're beginning to see they just don't satisfy. And of course they don't satisfy. Because they weren't designed to. The gifts that God gives were given to enrich our lives as our lives revolve around Him. But when we try and make those gifts do a job they weren't designed for, they just keep on failing on us, don't they? Let me tell you a reasonably boring story about a bridge. Unless, of course, you're a bridge enthusiast, at which point this might be your favourite part of the sermon. There was a bridge, and it was a good bridge. It was built well. And it was built so that it could take 5 tons. But when they put the bridge up, when they were putting the finishing touches on, someone put the wrong sign on. And it said 10 tons. So all the lorries and the cars kept on going over it. And what happened? Soon enough, the bridge failed. So what do? They fixed it up, good as new. But soon enough again, the bridge failed. And the bridge just kept on failing. Why? Well, it wasn't a rubbish bridge, it was a good bridge. But they were asking it to carry a weight that it wasn't designed for. They were asking it to do a job that it wasn't meant to do. And maybe that's what you're doing with the things that God has given. You've taken the good gifts that God has given and you've made them your little idols. And your life revolves around those things. And yet you're giving them a job that they weren't designed to do. You're putting too much weight on them. They can't handle that kind of weight. And therefore those little idols, they keep on failing you, don't you? Don't they? And like this woman, you keep on feeling thirsty for something more. And you can't describe it. You don't know how to even define it. But you just know that you haven't got it. So you make your kids the centre of your life. But what happens when your kids fly the nest? What happens when your little idols run away and don't need you anymore? Or you, like this woman, you look to relationships. But what happens when the relationship ends? And you're left feeling empty and alone. Or maybe you're just living for fun times and all that you can experience and all that you can enjoy in this world. But what happens when the fun times come to an end? Or you're living for money and the stuff that you own. But what happens when you're at death's door? And all of the stuff you've accumulated in your life is worthless to you then. You see, you put your hope in these little idols. You look to these things for satisfaction, for fulfillment, for purpose, for meaning. And you find they just can't do it. They just don't satisfy. That's what this woman had found, wasn't it? Maybe you're a young person here today. You've been brought up in a Christian family. And you think, you know, you've seen through all this Christianity stuff. You've worked it out. This isn't the answer. And maybe you think, as soon as I'm free from the shackles of my parents, then I'll go out and I'll live my life. I'll do all those things that I always wanted to do. I'll enjoy myself. I'll find what I've really been looking for. I'll find that purpose, that meaning, my own identity, and I'll find it all out there. But you won't. And maybe 30 or 40 years down the line, you'll be in the same position as this woman. A lifetime of regrets, still feeling thirsty for something you can't quite describe, but knowing that you haven't got it. So we come to our third and our final point. Who can satisfy that inner thirst that we have? Who can give real meaning and purpose and fulfillment to your life? Who can forgive the sins of a past life lived ignoring God? Who can take away all of that shame and that regret and that guilt that you feel? Who can give you that relationship with God? Who, if this woman was alive today, who would she point you to as the answer to your inner thirst? Who can satisfy where all of your idols have failed? Well, there's only one man who's capable of taking that load. There's only one man whose identity qualifies him as the one who can provide you living water and a relationship with God. A relationship that will give and keep on giving. Who's the man that you need? You need Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. And you need him tonight.